Howdy doody, everybody. There goes the microphones now. The red light is on, and we're off and running, flying across the airwaves. Good afternoon, everybody. Stan Turner with you. Thank you for your company. We can feel your presence on this not-too-bad first day of February. Thank goodness we have January in the rearview mirror. In fact, we have really been pounded since December. The National Weather Service tells us that during December and January, we have suffered 33 days of temperatures zero or below. Huh? Is that punishment? Is that Well, anyway, we hope February teaches us treats us a whole lot better. We surely do. And let's see. So January was a bad month for us. It's gone now. And poor Justin Bieber. January was just a frightful month for that poor guy, too. I know he's my role model. George, how about you?
I don't think so, but
this guy, let's see, he whacked some limo driver in Toronto at the back of the head, so he has to go back there to face charges. I mean, don't we all do that when we're 19? By golly. And then what was he, racing his yellow Lamborghini in Miami under the influence of something or other, and he's in trouble there, too. But, you know what I think we ought to do? Our hearts ought to go out to the guy. You know, he's put upon, isn't he? Let's send him a fruit basket, George. What do you say? You think that'll pep him up a little bit?
Huh? It might.
Justin, if you're listening, and I know you are, we really love you. Well, okay, let's carry on here. I just had to vent a little bit. Okay. Oh, boy. Well, I got to tell you, folks, Riley Spartz is in harm's way again. The intrepid Twin Cities television investigative reporter slash super sleuth has sunk her journalistic teeth into another murderous mystery, one that unfolds in the pages of Julie Kramer's latest novel. Did I say teeth? Well, funny I should mention that, because a nearly full set of teeth winds up in Riley's newsroom mailbox, and therein hangs a tale of murder and woe. Julie Kramer joins us in studio at the bottom of the hour this noon to talk about the latest perils of Riley Spartz. But first, oh boy, how many of us have had pen pals sometime in our lives? Schools, you know, back when I was going there, encouraged us to find overseas pen pals, especially, with whom we could exchange, you know, tidbits about our lives here and there, perhaps form long-lasting bonds with people of different places, different cultures. Fun. Pen pals can take many forms and lead to some amazing friendships. One such story debuts tonight on the stage of the History Theater in downtown St. Paul. The place in the story, Sheboygan, Wisconsin. The time, the 1950s and 60s, and the characters, baseball icon Jackie Robinson, future President John F. Kennedy, and a little kid nobody ever heard of, yet he's the one who brought them together. And yes, quite a pen pal relationship came out of this extraordinary alliance. We are fortunate to have two of the performers who bring this story to life at History Theater. Ansa Achea portrays Jackie Robinson, and Jack Alexander has the role of Ronnie Rabinowitz, the young boy who idolized Jackie Robinson and who stands at the center of the story. With us, too, Ron Peluso, artistic director at History Theater and director of this play, which we say opens tonight at History Theater, The Incredible Season of Ronnie Rabinowitz. Ron, welcome back. Congratulations. How did you pull all these strands together and make a great story out of this thing?
Well, it's a good story. A friend of ours who is a music producer and actually helped with our Buddy Holly production came to the show at theater one night, and he said, I met this guy at a party, and I think there's a story here to tell. He was a pen pal with Jackie Robinson for 17 years. And I thought, okay, that's sweet. And he's got all these letters. Yeah. And he said, but his other good pal was Jack Kennedy. I said, okay, now you got my attention. So I met Ronnie Rabinowitz and went to his home, and he's got this room full of memorabilia about Jackie and all these letters and then all these photos of he and Jack Kennedy together.
Amazing.
And I thought, there must be some connection between these two. And amazingly enough, there is. And when you see the play tonight, it'll all become clear.
It will. Sheboygan, Wisconsin is the locus here. This is where this all happens, back in the 50s and 60s. The bratwurst capital of the world. Sheboygan, Wisconsin. What an unlikely, implausible place for all this to unfold.
But I spent a year there one summer.
Yeah, right. We have a lot of Wisconsin listeners. We love Sheboygan.
And I love Sheboygan.
I know you know the song. You threw that in there. Well, okay, we've got this kid, and what is his what was his fascination? I think it still is a fascination. This young white kid in Sheboygan, Wisconsin, Lily White community north of Milwaukee, he reaches out to this courageous black man who broke, it's almost a cliche to say, but he did. He broke the racial color barrier in Major League Baseball. A hero by any measure. But what was the attraction to this kid? After all, you know, the Milwaukee Braves normally would have been his team, right?
That's right.
But the Dodgers and Jackie Robinson. What's the connection? How did it happen?
Well, I can let Ansa, jump in on this a little bit.
But let's do that. Ansa, sure. You portray Jackie Robinson. How did this unlikely alliance happen?
Yeah, you know, I've had the pleasure of taking on the role of Jackie Robinson, and it's no small feat in terms of what he achieved. And we have to think, it's hard for the younger listeners maybe to imagine, but it was a time when, you know, we had segregation happening in the United States, and African Americans were not allowed, or we had separate, you know, everything from bathrooms to classrooms and whatnot. And Jackie Robinson struck up a friendship with this young man, Ronnie Rabinowitz, when his father actually introduced him to baseball and playing in the American pastime. And I think it was just the way he played. Literally, he was just an amazing athlete. We think of maybe someone like Bo Jackson, you know, someone like that who could play two or three sports. And Jackie Robinson was not an 18-year-old rookie. He was in his 20s when he broke through in the major league. So he's a mature athlete and man who also had very, very clear mandate as to how he was going to represent himself to the country and to the world and make his presence felt. And so Ronnie, I believe, that was a connection with mm-hmm. Ronnie Rabinowitz. Mm-hmm. He started writing, and mm-hmm. for some reason, Jackie started writing back and just kept up this relationship with this young man, and everything from family to business to spiritual aspects. And, you know, Jack Alexander can talk a little bit more about that, too.
Jack, what a character you portray. You've met the real Ronnie Rabinowitz, haven't you, several times?
Yes, I met him at his house, and I saw the same room as Ron Peluso did.
Right.
It's just amazing.
What's in there? Tell us what's in there. We won't give the address, but Jack, what's in there?
No, it's just photos and letters, and these letters aren't like, you know, hi, how you doing? Have a great time.
Yeah.
It's, you know, full-length letters. If you see them, like 2 to 3 pages long.
Wow.
And, and he has some stuff from Jack Kennedy and Jackie Robinson. It's really cool.
Jackie Robinson took the time during his playing years and after, too. They kept up this correspondence, didn't they, Jack?
Yeah.
They kept going. And there was real substance, as you're saying, right? It wasn't just, hi, how you doing?
Yeah.
Jackie was kind of a mentor to him, too, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. He taught him like a lot, and he really teaches him some life lessons throughout the play and in real life.
Wonderful. How old are you?
I'm 13.
13. Well, that's the right age, isn't it? Just he's right in there. The story, Ron. Let's see. Ronnie Rabinowitz is what, 10 in one location and 13 a little bit older.
Well, we decided. I mean, he knew Jack Kennedy when he was more like 15, okay. But his relationship with Jackie Robinson starts when he's like 9 and 10 years old. His dad writes Robinson and says, you know, on lawyer stationery.
Okay. And dad David was a lawyer in Sheboygan.
He was, interestingly enough, he was also one of the leaders of the Democratic Party. So at the same time he's introducing his son to baseball and Robinson, he's trying to get Jack Kennedy elected president. And so these two worlds actually intersect. Mm-hmm. And Ansa, you could talk a little bit about Jackie Robinson's political background, which makes the play most interesting.
Indeed. This is something I didn't realize until I looked at the background here. Jackie's politics versus JFK's politics.
Absolutely. And you know, we have a great time in the play written by Eric Simonson having that conversation, because most people don't recognize or realize or maybe remember that Jack Robinson was a Republican, and he was a staunch Republican. I mean, he backed Nixon, and he held on to everything.
That's staunch.
Yeah, right?
Make no mistake about that.
You're right. And we talk about the Checker speech. I mean, we make so many references to the conversations that were happening that a young Ronnie might have heard in the House at the time about politics, and we forget. how influential that was. 1960, what a turning point for America, and JFK coming up and his ideal and his ideas and who he was as a person. So we have this clash, if you will, but a very good clash. You know, it's about substantive ideas of what we see happening in the future.
And onto the man you portray, Jackie Robinson. He was a Republican because what? Of course, civil rights, but he looked at the Democratic Party and what did he see?
Right. He saw the Democratic Party as still really, you know, a bunch of Dixiecrats, but very still not progressive in terms of bringing people together. And he saw actually what Nixon was doing as number one, because he saw Nixon, the way he grew up, poor. He was from his part of the country, California. So there was a simpatico. They were more alike than different, you know. And because Nixon was willing to engage in terms of the racial disparities of black Americans at the time, he felt, okay, the Republican Party can make a systematic change in a very viable way that the Democrats at the time couldn't do.
We should note that Jack Kennedy, as a senator in 1957, voted against the first Civil Rights Act.
That's right.
Voted against it. So we have this stereotypical image of all Democrats lining up behind the Civil Rights Act. Well, by 65, most of them, or some of them,
right.
They got passed.
You know,
not before.
It's interesting that you can go online and see these letters, but Robinson not only wrote Ronnie Rabinowitz, but he wrote everybody. And he wrote President Eisenhower many times,
really?
And you can read letters that he tells Eisenhower, the civil rights movement isn't moving fast enough. You keep telling us to be patient, and we're tired of being patient. Nothing's happening.
Okay.
And then when Kennedy gets elected, he writes to Kennedy in 62 and says, Jack, I'm glad you're finally starting to move forward on some issues that you were so reticent to talk about earlier.
They did meet at one time, too, didn't they?
They did.
That's
and,
right.
And in our play, you'll see this historic meeting that we've kind of invented.
Right.
We don't know what happened behind closed doors.
Say, we imagined
yes.
it. Yes, mm-hmm. yes. This is good. But it is true to their political beliefs at the time,
yeah.
isn't it? It is.
And it's a fascinating... I mean, there's some surprises we can't tell you about what you'll see in the play.
Does that mean we should go to the play?
You better go see the play.
Right,
yes.
Answer, huh, Jack, is that a good idea, huh?
Yeah.
Jack, obviously, Jack Alexander, you didn't know anything about this situation, did you, before you came to the play? Who could blame you for not knowing?
Yeah.
Most adults don't know.
I mean, I knew who Jack Kennedy was only because of the assassination. We learned about that in school.
Yes.
And then I didn't know about Jackie Robinson until 42 came out, the movie 42.
The movie was your introduction to Jackie Robinson. What struck you about that movie?
You know, I just thought it was just amazing the way one man could change a whole...
Absolutely.
Topic about civil rights.
Yeah, he did. Think it took some courage, bravery?
It did, yeah.
Of course it did. The man was subject to death threats all along the way. Ansa, when did Jackie break the so-called color barrier in the majors? Was that back in the 40s, late 40s?
No, I think it was when he came...
47.
Yeah, 47.
Yeah,
47.
Okay,
that's right, late 47.
Yeah. I think his career from 47, then I think he retired in 57. In those years, he did great things at the plate, but he did great things for the cause, too.
Exactly. And, I mean, that's kind of why I wanted to sign on to this particular production of it. I had the pleasure and the honor of doing Jackie Robinson when he broke into the majors. And we always forget, well, what happens afterwards? What happens to our athletes in our communities afterwards? And what he did, he became an executive with Chock Full of Nuts, which was a coffee company. Right. And, I mean, you would think, well, then, you know, he's paid. Why would he engage again and just, you know, sit on his laurels and enjoy all that his comeuppance? But instead of that, exactly what Ron said, he wrote, not only in his autobiography, talks about how involved he was with the working class and how we have to change our perception of poverty in this country, because we all aspire, but we have to make the possibility a reality. So I think that's part of the conversation that we have in the play, is how he actually manifested his civic engagement as an executive, as when he became when he was out of baseball, and the engagement that he has with Ronnie Rabinowitz.
Mm-hmm.
He goes to Sheboygan to Manitowoc, really, mm-hmm. to give a speech that night, and that's something that we don't hear about. Well, what was that speech about?
Robinson gave a speech.
Robinson, right? Okay. Yeah, that night he goes, okay. And he was part of an alliance of what was called the JCC, what do we call it? No, the NCCJ, the National Conference of Christians and Jews.
Okay.
Yet another example of what this country's possibilities and realities are. We don't hear about that kind of engagement of our, you know, of our illustrious athletes, and that's something that Ronnie Brinovitz and Jackie have in common.
Jack Alexander, this is one heck of a history lesson for you, isn't it?
Yeah.
You've learned a ton. Do you tell your friends about it in school?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. I mean,
are they coming? They're going to come to see you, I hope.
I hope.
They better. Let's load up the buses and bring them down.
Yeah.
If I were a teacher, I would do that. I would definitely do that, and I think that's going to happen. But go ahead.
This he's been skipping school for this.
No. I don't think skipping is the correct verb. Have you been skipping, Jack?
No, it's a field trip.
Right. But so anyway, this is a real eye-opener and brain-opener for you.
I learned so much about civil rights and even more about the Cola Strike, which is another big part of the story because Ronnie Urbanovitz's dad was a huge lawyer on the Cola Strike.
Okay.
The longest strike in the history of the country happens at the time of this play.
What was the strike now?
Against the Kohler manufacturing company.
Kohler, K-O-H-L-E-R.
Yeah, who make bathroom plumbing and sinks
Wisconsin.
And toilets and
right.
the like.
Okay. All right.
And the company had been out on strike for 5 years, and the strike lasted almost six. And Kennedy is involved in the union movement with Bobby and the like. And Robinson is an executive who is management.
Wow.
So, I mean, there's all these issues that come into play in this play about Ronnie Rabinowitz, and it's through his eyes that we see the American political and social landscape being changed
this
before his eyes.
This has a lot of layers and angles.
It really does.
This is great, and they all come together. David Rabinowitz, the father of Ronnie, a lawyer, as we said, and he's what they call a progressive Democrat. He was for change. Let's get change going here. Let's get Kennedy elected, all this. And befriending Jackie Robinson, this black man in Lily White community, that brought down some umbrage, didn't it, on David, on the lawyer himself.
Yeah.
What happened to his office?
Well, the play, Eric decided to focus the play on one night, which is a true story, that Robinson was visiting and David Rabinowitz's law office got vandalized with huge, ugly graffiti.
Racist graffiti
that we would call a hate crime today.
Yes.
And so the play begins with that premise. They come home that night, and this is the night that Robinson would visit the Rabinowitz family.
Wow.
And so the play takes off from there.
Jack, I have to ask you something. At your age, at school, just if you can just give it to me straight. Among your fellow students, sisters, you know, do they talk about race? Does there seem to be this great divide between people of color, so-called color, and whites today? Is there any discussion about it? Or are kids colorblind these days, more or less?
Well, I mean, we learned about the civil rights in school, and I'm pretty sure we all believe it's wrong. And it was just a horrible time. But, you know, if you go into our school, you see, like, tables with white people, tables with black people.
Yes, yes.
And so, but then there's the tables where it's mixed, you know. You have Asians, blacks, and whites all sitting together.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Yeah, well, yeah, I think we all gravitate toward people we know best, but we also mix now, too. So, but you don't hear any undercurrent of, or even open statements of hatred toward people.
No, there really isn't any racism.
Oh, I was hoping you'd say. It's good to hear. I know racism still exists.
Right. It does.
Yes, it does. Sadly, we know that, but
horrible.
To a much lesser degree, we hope. We hope. It does flare up from time to time. So, what a story to be told. Ansa, you have portrayed Jackie Robinson before, I think, over at the Children's Theater.
That's right. Yeah, I had the honor and the privilege of doing it back at Children's Theater Company, I believe it was last year. And honestly, it's one of those plays where I'm speechless. I really can't even remember everything that happened because it was a dream.
Yep.
It was. Yep. It felt like a dream.
Yeah.
Let me just be really clear about this.
Yes.
I've never really had, as a professional, the opportunity to be in a state where the arts is so well maintained, meaning that we don't shy away from conversations. To think that, you know, this story is happening here at the History Theater or at Children's Theater Company and talking about race, gender, equality, all the issues that we think that we are not being exposed to in the news or whatnot, or maybe overexposed, we can actually have a conversation in the arts about that.
We don't blink, do we?
No.
We talk about it, and that's great. Right?
That's a testament to the arts.
It is, absolutely.
Right? Yeah.
Well, you know, this is a really interesting story. It's funny, it's entertaining, but there's also an important story to be told about who we were as Americans 50 years ago and who are we today.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it makes you really think about, you know, how race and gender and religion play into the world we live in.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an evolving country. It's an amazing story that we have to tell.
Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. is often called a pioneer, you know, of breaking down the racial barriers. Said pioneer, that was Jackie Robinson.
Exactly.
Did he say that?
Exactly,
yeah.
And he was there before, you know, those things were happening with Martin Luther King. Not to take absolutely anything away from what Martin Luther King did, Jr. did, but Jackie Robinson was the first.
Mm-hmm.
He absolutely was. And the things that he endured and the character and the love that he had to muster to face that is an example for any human being. It's not about race. It's really about that. And if we can just speak whenever there is inequality or injustice, we are better for it.
Right.
It is the hardest thing to do. But, you know, I forget, I'm going to mess up this quote, but, you know, if you stay silent when one person is being oppressed or whatnot, you are as guilty, if not
as
culpable.
That's a great paraphrase. You know, that's exactly the meat of it right there.
Yeah.
And I want to ask Jack Alexander, Ronnie Rabinowitz today, is he still compassionate about baseball, about Jackie Robinson, about JFK?
Yeah, I mean, it's an honor to play him, and it's so fun to watch him tell a story, because...
tell me about that. Why are you laughing? How does he tell a story?
Well, no, but when he says it, you can see it on his face, he's just so happy,
and he
you know, he loved every minute of it.
Right. And he cherishes those letters. And even after Jackie Robinson's playing days, he's still advising Ronnie, it is good that you're losing weight. You need to lose weight. That will help you feel better.
That's right.
He took a real human-to-human interest in the kid, the boy, didn't
Absolutely.
He? He really did.
And Ronnie will be there.
Ah,
yeah, that's right.
Yes.
Almost every night. And on Sunday afternoons, after the show, he'll be talking with the audience about his real-life experience.
Yep. Ronnie left the bratwurst capital of the world behind Sheboygan and now lives in a Minneapolis suburb, I think.
He does.
Yeah?
He lives in that shining city on the hill.
Yes.
He died.
I grew up next door. We were a little lower. we were beneath the hill, and the wattage wasn't quite as bright. St. Louis Park, and I love it.
Yeah. I've heard of that place.
You have. Looking forward to this. It sounds like a great mix of serious storytelling as well as some light moments, too.
Yeah.
This should be great. Ron, we need for you to tell us where history... I can't believe anybody doesn't know where it is, but if they
where
don't
is
know...
The history
where
theater?
Is the History Theater?
We are in downtown St. Paul at the corner of Wabasha and 10th Street, right, as I say, below the state capitol, front door across from the interstate. Easy to get to.
All right.
Go on our website, historytheater.com, and find out where we are.
How long will this play, The Incredible Season of Ronnie Rabinowitz, be on stage at History Theater?
We open tonight. We run through February 23rd.
Okay.
So month of February is dedicated to Ronnie Rabinowitz and his friends.
All right. Yeah. That's great. Happens to be Black History Month, too,
That's right.
Well, Ron, can you give us just a brief look at what's going to be on stage after this particular production?
Coming up, we have two really unique stories about veterans. We're doing Tim O'Brien's The Things They Carried, which is the quintessential Vietnam story. He was a McAllister grad from Worthington, Minnesota, and he wrote this incredible book about his Vietnam experience. One-person show starring Stephen D'Ambrose. And then a piece called Lonely Soldiers, Women at War in Iraq. And these two plays run together. This is by Helen Benedict, and these are the real voices of women who fought in the Iraqi war and deal with sexual harassment and dealing with combat issues and coming home as veterans. And then following that, we're doing a musical called The Working Boys Band about the Minneapolis kids who pick up instruments and got themselves out of the pool halls and out of Glick's Cafe.
What a concept.
And a musical by Dominic Orlando and the late Hiram Titus, who just passed away.
Yes, okay.
But he finished the music just in time. So Working Boys Band will be our last show of the season.
Well, that's wonderful. A great lineup, as always. We want to thank you, Ron Peluso, Artistic Director of the History Theater in St. Paul. You're directing this production, are you not, right?
I am, with the help of Ansa and Jack.
Right.
Yes.
Jack, make sure you help Ron, will you? He sometimes needs it, okay?
Okay, I got it.
Congratulations to you, Jack. I'm looking forward to seeing you on stage. And Ansa, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is going to be a great experience for all of us to come down and see this wonderful story unfold before our eyes. Folks, once again, the incredible season of Ronnie Rabinowitz, now playing, opening tonight on the stage at History Theater in downtown St. Paul. Thanks to all of you.
Thank you, Stan. We'll be right back.
Thank you. Julie Kramer and another whodunit. Keep your head down right after this. At the Stan Turner Show, we love good stories, and there's no better place to find them than Valley Bookseller in downtown Stillwater. Valley Bookseller is an independent bookstore with knowledgeable and friendly staff who love books. Tell them what you like to read, and they'll make terrific recommendations just for you. Also, discover one of the finest children's collections in the entire Twin Cities. Valley Bookseller, great books, great people. 217 North Main in Stillwater. Online at valleybookseller.com.
At Jaime's Haberdashery, men never sacrifice fashion for weather. So no matter how cold it gets, you can still spot a Jaime's man by his impeccable taste and the confidence that only comes from a hot lather shave. Jaime's Haberdashery helps men look and feel their best with high-quality clothing cut and styled just for them. Create a look that's uniquely yours with tailored suits, overcoats, hats, and accessories that make winter blush and at prices that won't melt your wallet. Jaime's Haberdashery, 400 St. Peter Street, in downtown St. Paul, online at Jaime's.com.
Come and join us for the daytime dinner theater experience at Ideal Hall. This month we are featuring the music of Steve Kovacs and Julie Easterly as they sing us down memory lane. We'll hear songs of Nat King Cole, Gershwin, Sinatra, Eva Cassidy, and Diana Krall. We'll also enjoy their delightful banter. The show will be performed on Tuesday, February 18th at Ideal Hall. Bring a friend, or just bring the entire neighborhood. Ideal Hall is located in St. Paul at 1494 Dale Street. Doors open at 11:30. Meal is at noon. Show starts at 1:15. Free parking, handicap accessible, delicious dinners by TST Creative Catering, all for the price of only $20. For more information and to make reservations, call Presence Promotions at 651-489-9617. Again, that's Steve Kovacs and Julie Easterly at Ideal Hall on Tuesday, February 18th. For more information, call Presence Promotions at 651-489-9617.
We are carrying on here on this Saturday afternoon. The sun is punching through. How nice to see it. I think we've got about 18 degrees going here. Hallelujah. What a nice break after what we've been through. Ooh, ooh. Stan Turner with you here. Part two of our show this noon hour. Julie Kramer is at it again. Our local murder mystery writer with a national following is taking us on yet another excursion through the underworld of crime most foul. It's a bit like those Halloween freakout tours you take in late October. You know the ones. Scary, scary. This one's really scary. As always, Twin Cities television investigative reporter Riley Spartz is prominent among those squarely in the crosshairs as she tries to get at truth and justice the American way. Sounds like Superman, doesn't it, George?
Sort of, yeah.
Yeah, it's a noble, noble undertaking. All right. Welcome, Julie.
That was bad, Stan.
Wait, we got some bad puns coming, don't we, huh? Welcome back, m'lady. Well,
thank you so much, Stan.
This is an honor. We have visited with you like this. The rollout of every one of your mysteries going back to Stalking Susan.
Absolutely.
We were stalking her in what year, Julie? What
2008.
Was okay. So. And then what happened? Mark went missing.
Mark. Yeah, we had missing Mark.
Okay. And then
Sam went silent.
Silencing Sam. Kate got killed. Killing Kate is the name. And then Sarah, what happened to her?
She was shunned.
She was shunned. Shunning Sarah. George, I think you've read just about all of these, haven't you?
I have all of them, thank you.
You have indeed. And now we have the heartwarming title of your latest, Delivering Death. Okay, Julie, you're just looking at me like that. And you just handed me a little chocolate, a little bite-sized chocolate, all wrapped up beautifully, as you'd see little... Yeah, you have one too, George.
And it looks like my book cover.
Which says what on the cover?
Delivering Death.
Delivering Death.
If Stan's brave enough to eat something that says Delivering Death.
You know, I am a certified card-carrying coward, so you knew... But I will anyway, because I'm a fool for chocolate. Well, congratulations on your latest book.
Thanks so much.
We always have to walk the literary type road here. We don't want to give the whole plot or plot lines. There are several plots going on here. We don't want to give them away, but it's worth tantalizing the listener because there's so much going on here. I'm a big fan of a PBS series. I think it's now silenced for a while, called Foyle's War, written by a guy named Andrew Horowitz, and he's got about five plot lines going at the same time, and you wonder, how can this possibly be tied up in a coherent conclusion? But he does it, and you do the same thing so well. There's so much going on here. We've got Riley Spartz again right at the center.
Well, I like to think that I'm mimicking what it's like in a television newsroom. And as
I've been there, Julie.
a reporter doesn't have the luxury of just working on one story forever. They're juggling multiple stories. So in reading my book, my reporter is juggling quite a few crime things going on, and I do have to wrap them all up at some point. And the part where the plots and the subplot intersect, for me, is always like a thing of beauty.
Mm-hmm.
When that happens,
it
becomes clear to the reader, okay, that's why that was important.
Precisely. All the pieces are fitting together, and sometimes I wonder, how are you going to do this? This can't work. This can't fit. But you do.
I don't always know how I'm going to do it either.
How do you do? How do you conceive of a story? Are you driving along? Do you sit in a workroom that says Julie's, you know, think tank? Or are you out there driving through a blizzard and the storyline comes to you?
I start with a premise, and I start writing, and I don't know who the killer is. In this case, I started with the premise of my heroine gets a package of teeth in the mail at the station.
Say that again, Julie.
My heroine gets a mysterious package in the mail, and it contains teeth. And she does what any of us would do and takes them to her dentist. So if you have a dentist friend out there, it's a marvelous book, and you learn a little bit about St. Apollonia, the patron saint of dentists.
Is there such a thing?
Yes, there is.
Saint Apollonia. George, did you know that?
Yes, I
no,
did.
No, I did not.
Well, George, you know it now, don't you?
Yes, I do.
And if you read my book, you'll learn more about it.
Wow.
I did, you know, good research on that.
Dentists have their own... Well, the dentist looks at these teeth most foul, no doubt, that came to Riley Spartz in the mail in an unmarked envelope, I guess, in the newsroom.
And that's kind of how it starts, but I'm highly influenced by happenings around me as I write. And while I was writing, Minnesota was, you know, in the news with a lot of, with a couple of high-profile white-collar crime cases.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so Julie says, going to crank those in there, too.
Yeah.
Teeth and high-profile crime cases.
White-collar crime.
White-collar crime.
Yeah.
It's not always the low, low, low,
well,
low.
Well, but there's
types.
Some low
They're
crime
low,
in here,
but
too.
They have white
yeah.
collars, don't
yeah.
they?
Yeah, yeah.
That's the difference. Well, Riley Spartz, you know, I want to back up a minute. Describe her for us. First, physically and then journalistically. What's this lady look like? What's she all about?
She has spent a career in television news, and she's in her mid-30s. Okay. So there are younger people in the newsroom making less money than her. But she is really caught up in, you know, the mission of journalism. She really wants to break news. She doesn't want to necessarily, you know, cave. In this particular case, she in Delivering Death, money, marriage, and madness collide. And
it's a heck of a collision, lady.
And, you know, she follows this the package of teeth, and various clues lead her to an identity theft ring.
Hmm.
And identity theft is in the news a lot
very
now.
Big, almost topic day, isn't
and,
it, right now?
Mm-hmm. And her boss, in this particular case, thinks that that sounds a little dull. And even though there is a homicide involved, he thinks that the station will get higher ratings if she covers a giant wedding at the Mall of America. And she is resistant to that because she truly believes the mission of news is to, tell people things they need to know.
How many of us like that are left?
Well, you tell me.
Well, I was in it. It's a fight. I like. She's a zealot, isn't she?
Yes,
she's
yes.
a zealot, a journalistic zealot. She wants to do what's correct, what's right. Go after the important stories, not the flash and trash. The
and
truth
the,
is, Julie, as you know, having worked at Channel 4, a lot of people, a lot of viewers, and this is not a put-down, like flash and some trash, too, don't they?
And her boss may entirely be right, and maybe a giant wedding will get higher ratings. But, you know, she's kind of debating, and in her mind, she's constantly constantly wondering about, you know, the mission and the direction of television. Mm-hmm. And in my books, I always try and incorporate some journalistic issues, some, you know, ethical dilemmas, newsroom politics, and some of the things that unfold.
You know of what you write because you headed up the, was it the I-Team?
Yes.
For a while at Channel 4, WCCO. My mouth is not used to saying those call letters.
I'm lucky.
KSTP-TV comes a little more naturally to me. I was there for a while, 3 decades, as news director, too, among other things. But you know of what you talk, and you know of what you speak, and you know what you're writing about, so...
And, I mean, I'm fortunate in that I was able to live my research when it comes to the TV news aspect of it, but we all have to do, as authors, additional research for our stories.
Do you ever?
And in this particular case, one of the things that I did for research was I attended an auction for some of Tom Petter's goods.
Mm-hmm. That's at a place that actually exists, too, isn't
yes.
it? I go there quite often.
Yeah.
You mention it in the book.
Luther Auction in North St. Paul. Mm-hmm. So I walked in. And it was actually the same night that Dark Star's goods were being auctioned off. So there was a huge crowd. They combined the two estates. And if you're a white-collar criminal and get convicted and have a lot of goods, the government will confiscate your stuff and sell it, you know, to put into a crime victims fund. And it's pennies, you know.
Dark Star was not a... Dark Star
No.
We want to make sure we take him
Tom
out of that
Petters.
Tom Petters.
Anyway,
okay.
So
that
I
just
applied...
just eliminated a lawsuit right there. Okay,
I applied for a bid number. And to get that, I had to fill out paperwork asserting that I had no direct connection to the case and any of the parties of the case. So I filled that out, you know, gave them my credit card, and they gave me a bidding number. And I didn't actually want to buy anything, but I wanted kind of bragging rights of having bid on something. And as I was scoping out the merchandise, there was a very large piece of artwork that another gentleman was looking at. And it was like 4 feet by 6 feet. And it had, it was called Reclining Bird. And he was talking on the phone and pointing to it, and I'm thinking, okay, he really wants that, you know, piece of art. And when it came up to bid, the auctioneer, you know, was looking around the room, and I thought, okay, this is my chance. So I raised my hand and bid on it. And nobody else bid.
Oh.
So now I own this very ugly piece of artwork, which is sitting gathering dust in my basement. It was lucky we had the van to be able to transport it home.
What did it cost you? Can you tell us?
I bid $60.
Okay.
And with the tax and other fees, it was $74.
$74. That's
so,
not. You've got all
you know,
there.
If anyone's easy. Interested, you know, contact me afterwards. We might be able to work out a deal, but you'll need some kind of a truck to haul it. But it becomes a scene in the book.
Okay. Indeed. Ugly painting, but it's a feature of the
book.
Well,
and you know, you take your inspiration where you get it.
You do.
That becomes part of the storyline.
We are talking with Julie Kramer, her new whodunit murder mystery starring, involving her protagonist, the heroine, I would say, Riley Spartz, intrepid television news reporter for Channel 3, I believe it is.
Channel 3.
Falls somewhere between Channel 4 and 5, doesn't it, huh? And it's called Delivering Death, and oh, man, what a thriller. This takes some weird, I might say, morbid turns here, and we want to talk about a particular piece of research you did, and I still can't believe you did it, Julie, but you did do it, didn't you? And we'll talk about it right after this. To really experience a book, meet the author. I'm Stan Turner for Valley Bookseller in downtown Stillwater. Every month, Valley Bookseller's calendar is loaded with events featuring both local and national authors. Visit valleybookseller.com and click the events calendar for a complete list. Choose from monthly events like the Totally Criminal Cocktail Hour or special presentations with authors on tour. Meet your favorite author at Valley Bookseller. Great books, great people. 217 North Main in Stillwater.
Did you know we had fingerprints before we were even born?
We did?
Yep, when we were only 9 weeks old.
My mom says our hearts were beating too.
Well, my mom says I could suck my thumb and smile before I was even born.
You still do. You don't have to tell.
Hello, my name is Marianne Koharski, and I'm the director of Pro-Life Across America, the Billboard People. If you know someone who is pregnant or in need of information and alternatives, including adoption, or would like to support the work of Pro-Life Across America, please call 1-800-366-7773 or visit our website at prolifeacrossamerica.org. Pro-Life Across America, non-political and totally educational.
A baby's heart is beating 18 days from conception.
At Jaime's Haberdashery, men never sacrifice fashion for weather. So no matter how cold it gets, you can still spot a Jaime's man by his impeccable taste and the confidence that only comes from a hot lather shave. Jaime's Haberdashery helps men look and feel their best with high-quality clothing cut and styled just for them. Create a look that's uniquely yours with tailored suits, overcoats, hats, and accessories that make winter blush. And at prices that won't melt your wallet. Jaime's Haberdashery, 400 St. Peter Street in downtown St. Paul. Online at Jaime's.
Okay, I think we had a little extra drum riff in there. I like drums, so that was good. It's 12:45 right now, around 18 degrees in the Twin Cities. Where are we going today in terms of high temperature? Let me see. I think we're there. We've topped out right now. Overnight low minus 8. Tomorrow plus 10. We start the new week with about what we have right now, a high of 18 degrees. Thank you so much. Stan Turner with you here, one of our favorite guests, one of our finest writer. She lives here, but is a national figure in the murder mystery genre, Julie Kramer. Julie, so nice to see you again. You have been down in the valley here, the Valley of the Valley. A while ago, you did something with our great sponsors. We just heard them, Valley Bookseller.
Yeah, in fact, I just stopped in on my way here to say hi to them.
Had a great
shop.
And
they have some signed copies of my book, so anybody who wants a copy can, you know, head on down.
I was in there last night. They have, to put a precise point to it, 31 copies of your book there, and I'm guessing it'll be far fewer when we get done with this today. Or is it okay? So good. Great great shop over there. And something, you have an event later today?
I have an event in downtown Hudson at 4 o'clock today, Chapter 2 Books. Mm-hmm. But then later this month, February 11th at 7 o'clock at night, I'm going to be in Woodbury at the Central Park Amphitheater for an event called Club Book, and Valley Booksellers is one of the sponsors, and we'll be selling books there.
And the focus is on Julie's latest called Delivering Death, a novel. And my
One thing I should mention, Valentine's Day is coming up.
Wait a minute. Death and Valentine's Day.
Well, the stunning conclusion of Delivering Death happens on Valentine's Day.
It does, doesn't
so
it?
So if you're looking for, you know, the perfect gift for your Valentine, a signed copy is such a thoughtful gift.
Uh-huh. How about some extra teeth, too? Are you giving away teeth, too? Is that a good idea? Huh?
Well, yeah. I mean,
At your book signings? Oh, here's a tooth.
No, but, you know, if you want to, like, give a copy to your dentist, you know, your dentist would probably appreciate it a lot.
What's the saint again of dentists? What is that?
Saint Apollonia.
Apollonia, of course. Now we know that.
Used to be Princess Girlfriend.
Yes. That's where I've heard it. All right, Julie, let's get to it here. In the course of doing your research for your latest book, Delivering Death, you went on some odd outings, I would say, a little bizarre. One took you to a local...
I like to live my research. I like to...
Or live it? Is that the right verb? I'm not sure.
I'm dying to do good research.
Oh, okay. George, you accused me of bad puns. You just heard a whole fusillade of them right there from her. Julie Kramer went to a local funeral home. And tell us, Julie, what you did.
Tell us, Julie. Don't
hold back.
I made sure I went on a day when there wasn't a funeral going on. The parking lot was empty. I wanted to write a scene, not cause one. But my mission was to lay inside a casket with the lid shut.
That would beg another question. Why?
Well, I thought it would be useful in the writing of this book, you know, just to kind of experience, you know, this claustrophobia. And, you know, I was interested in, would somebody, you know, be able to, like, breathe inside? I walked in the door
most occupants wouldn't be worried about that, would they? Whether they could breathe inside.
It was Mueller Lake Mortuary in White Bear Lake.
Okay.
Young woman greeted me and asked if she could help, and I said, yes, I'd like to see some caskets.
Had you called ahead to tell me?
No. If you call ahead, then they just say no. You know, you were a newsman.
I know it was a rhetorical question.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Anyway, so I walked in, and she took me to the showroom. I had not realized this, but, you know, funeral homes, like car dealerships, have showrooms with the latest models.
Sure.
And she's showing me the caskets, and the kinds of questions I'm asking are not ones that, you know, she typically gets asked, because I'm saying, okay, let's say someone had to hide in a casket. Would they suffocate? How much time would they have? And she explained that as long as it wasn't sealed, you know, you'd still be able to breathe, but you might have some issues with, you know, panic and claustrophobia, depending on, you know, what, you know, your life experiences were.
Yeah.
And I explained to her then that I wasn't actually searching to, you know, to make a purchase, but I was here doing research. I was an author. I think I handed her a bookmark with my picture on it, like that proved anything. And you know,
we get so people like you
she,
all the time.
She has, well, apparently there are people who have casket fetishes who sometimes show up at funeral homes. So, you know, they want to make sure that, you know, I really am an author. Mm-hmm. And apparently had, you know, heard of my book, so that was useful. And, you know, we did some more chit-chatting and then got to, you know, the money question, which was, would you mind if I tried one out? And her initial,
what was the look on her
face? Her initial reaction was, you know, it might tip over, our insurance wouldn't cover it, that's probably not a really good idea. And you know, in the
She's
world
really
of news
trying to be diplomatic,
in the world of news you could be persuasive. And I said, well, what if we move that chair over here from the corner over here, and you know, I climbed in that way, I mean, that might work out. So she said, okay, all right, well, let's hurry up before anybody else gets in here. So you know, she opened, you know, the casket, you know, the full way, you know, and helped me climb in. And I'm laying there, and it was more comfortable than I expected.
Really?
I mean, the padding was good. It was a nice pillow.
Does it have a sleep number on it, too, where you can adjust the mattress setting
you
from
know,
firm to soft, Julia?
If we're using, you know, car analogies, it had a lot of legroom. Good legroom. And, you know, then we got to the point where, you know, I said, okay, so how about if you shut the lid? And she's explained to me now, okay, breathe real slowly now, because we don't want, you know, any kind of trouble. So just remember to breathe slowly. Let me know if, you know, you're feeling anything, you know. And we had only known each other a few minutes, so it did require a certain amount of trust on my part. So she shut it. One of the things I wanted to know is, would the person inside be able to hear what was going on? Mm-hmm. You know, and I could hear good. We kept talking, so I could hear her. And there was also this, you know, kind of a dull little line of, you know, light, because it hadn't been sealed, you know, kind of around the middle. There were about 6 inches of space from my, you know, face to the top of the lid.
How charming.
Yeah.
Did your husband...
Luckily, I got out alive, unlike
some
of my characters.
I see that. Yes. Yes, indeed. I know that, too. Did you tell your husband and your offspring that you were going to do this?
I'm not sure that I did. Certainly not
my
kids.
You're not sure that you did. Did you or did you not?
Well, because I didn't know what was going to happen, you know? And you know, I think later on I told them.
Okay, so you did it first, told them later. Okay.
Yeah.
So it was a value, was it, to the writing of your story?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think everything you can do to make your story come alive is good.
The puns
for the reader.
Keep coming, don't they, George? Yes, indeed.
Oh, yes, they do.
Your next book will be what? Seeking the wackiest puns in captivity. I don't know, Riley Spartz. Well, Riley Spartz, she has survived all kinds of trauma through all of your novels. She's had some near-death experiences, hasn't she? In windmills or, you know, that sort of wind farms, that sort of thing. And there's some sense that she worried that she's slipping from what she calls cynical to bitter as she sees this terrible stuff in newsrooms where there's more accent on flash and trash than there is on substance, and just seeing the general human condition of murder and mayhem. Is she becoming... cynic is bad enough, but...
You know, I mean, she's been through a lot, and in the course...
But nobody's forcing her to do this, are they?
Well, you know, we all have to earn a living.
We do.
You know, she's got to learn a living.
And be a librarian, too.
Libraries aren't, you know, hiring too many people these days,
I know,
Stan.
That's true. Books, what are those? Okay.
Anyway, right. But... one of the things that's a challenge is I'm writing with my heroine being a TV news reporter. Mm-hmm. And there's a feeling in publishing that to be, you know, successful, you need to have a likable protagonist. Mm-hmm. And the latest Gallup poll on that issue found that America's trust in TV news was at an all-time low. So my challenge as a writer is, how do I make my protagonist likable when mm-hmm. so much of America despises what she does for a living?
Mm-hmm.
And so... you know, the balance that I'm at is that she is aware of some of the, you know, faults of her profession, and, you know, discusses them. There's a lot of good internal dialogue mm-hmm. with what's happening in the world of news mm-hmm. from her end. And I think people really like that. And one of the things that I think is, you know, the greatest compliment that I can be paid is when people tell me that after they read my books, they watch news in a different way.
Oh, right. How so? To see whether the junk triumphs and the
Well, or just to see how it's put together and to mm-hmm. say, hey, you're right. They do a lot of animal stories, because in my book there's usually always some kind of an animal story mm-hmm. because news directors think that animal stories attract viewers, which is why we always see pictures of the new baby animals at the zoo mm-hmm. and, you know, various things like that. Mm-hmm. And they'll tell me that, you know, they'll read my books and then observe that some of the things are indeed right. One of them said that they were, like, at some place and saw a teleprompter rolling, mm-hmm. and it had the narrow line of script just like in my books.
Yes, yes. So bringing it all home to them, it's real.
Right, and what they don't realize is there's competition, they know, between TV stations and newspapers and between various TV stations, mm-hmm. but they don't understand that within a television station there also is competition mm-hmm. for who gets the lead story and who gets to have a long story and who gets to travel for a story.
Mm, true.
Things like that.
All true. All true, indeed. Why is the public perception of journalists, TV journalists among them, so low?
Well, I mean, I don't actually know.
What's your guess?
Well, I think that, you know, everybody's a critic. And you watch the news and you always think you could do it differently. And I think a lot of news now, the different cable networks might be delivering news with an agenda. And if you don't agree with that agenda, or if you do agree with one of those agendas and are mm-hmm. watching mainstream television news, then you're angry because it's not promoting the agenda that mm-hmm. you agree in.
Okay.
And, you know, news has changed a lot. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it's 24/7. And with the internet, you're not just doing, in newspapers, you used to be doing a story, you know, you'd mm-hmm. file a story, you know, at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. And TV, you might do two or three versions of the story that day. Mm-hmm. But now with the internet, it's 24/7 news you're filing all day long.
No, it's different. Far fewer people are watching local and network television news than they did when you and I were in the newsrooms. Far fewer, because there are so many other distractions, places for them to go.
And when, you know, stuff is posted on the internet, sometimes you don't always get the you know, facts checking
well,
that you might not have otherwise, because there's so much competition to be
first.
And it's not being first by breaking the story at 6 o'clock or 10 o'clock. It's, you know, breaking it as soon as you hear about it.
Be careful what you're seeing and reading on the internet, because it may not be so. That's the big caveat right now. Delivering Death, Julie Kramer's latest whodunit. A great story, a great read. It'll keep your attention. Believe me, the pages will turn. Riley, this has another one of your, what I call, Wagnerian endings. All fire and thunder.
Well,
but then it settles down, and is a very nice epilogue to it.
I mean, it's a nice, you know, if you're from Minnesota or you know somebody who's left the state, it'll make them homesick or glad they left. But it uses real locations and landmarks. We've got everything from the Spam Museum to the Mary Tyler Moore statue to the Mall of America. Mm-hmm.
To the Rest in Peace Funeral Home.
Yes.
Thank you so much. Julie, thank you. Please stay away from funeral homes for a while now, will you, please? Huh? Best of luck on this. Thank you so much. Once again, your appearance this afternoon will be...
It'll be downtown Hudson at Chapter 2 Books at 4 o'clock. And then later this month, just before Valentine's Day, February 11th at 7 o'clock in Woodbury at the Central Park Amphitheater. I'm there as part of a club book series that's coming around the Twin Cities. And Valley Booksellers is one of the sponsors. And we have books there, you know, for people to purchase, and I'd be happy to personalize one for the special Valentine in your life.
That's so tender. Thank you. Julie Kramer, stop by and see her at these book signings.
Yeah, for an edgy Valentine.
Yeah. Julie, okay. Thank you, Julie Kramer. Oh, my, oh, my. Riley Spartz lives. Keep your head down, Riley. There's danger out there. So it's 12:58 right now, 18 degrees. Thank you so much for your company. Please do remember to join us at noon this coming Monday. In fact, Monday through Friday, noon to 2, for the All Request and Dedication program. I'm happy to be your host, so join us there. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you. Bye-bye.